Okay, the last week we went through the entire question of Rashi and transitioned to Tosfos. What did Tosfos really accomplish? What did they do? How did they change things? For those people who are going to listen to this on YU Torah, should know that I didn't put up that I didn't upload that shiur because I think I did it better the last time I did it. So it's under Rishonim, introduction to Rishonim number 2. But here we're going to today we're starting something Monty Python would say completely different. Every single literary and intellectual trend in the world has a life. And the truth of the matter is that that even the sheet of Balei HaTosfos had a certain life to it. In other words, there's a lot. But in terms of revolutionary insights into the Gemara, most of the serious basic work from which we still live was done by 4 people, 5 people. Rabbeinu Tam, Ri Hazaken, his nephew, and the Ri's major Talmidim, Rabbeinu Elchanan, his son, who died al Kiddush Hashem, Reb Shimon Shem Rishon, who we talked about we talked about his brother last week, the Rash Mishans, Reb Baruch of Paris, of France. They used to call him Baruch. We know he wasn't from Mainz. He was actually French, who wrote the Sefer HaTrumah. And Rabbi Yehuda Sir Leon. Those are the names of the major Balei HaTosfos. Everybody else, especially after in the 13th century, basically wrote either sort of footnotes to what they had already done. The Rosh Mishans, also from Sens, made Aliyah together with traditionally 300 rabbis in the year 1211. And the truth of the matter is that by that time, the creative part of the period of the Balei HaTosfos was over. From then on, they're editing, they're doing something in Yiddish that's called Ibruzogen, repeating that which, thank you very much, that which, other people had said. I'll give you an example. Something similar is happening, in fact, happened in the 20th century, just whatever. In the late 19th, early 20th century, in Lithuania, there was a revolution in terms of the way of terms of learning. In terms of the Derech HaLimud. We generally associate it with Reb Chaim. But the truth of the matter is you have a cluster of just outstanding minds who are functioning in the major yeshivas, in Volozhin, and in Mir, and in Slobodka, and in wherever they tells whatever you wherever you want. Okay. After World War II, for reasons that are not necessarily related to the war, by the way, the Lithuanian yeshivas and others end up using the insights and the svaras and the ideas that are developed by Rab Chaim and Rav Shimon Shkop and Rab Baruch Ber and Rab Elchanan Wasserman and whoever else. But they're not creating. They're using. They're plugging in. They're saying over. Questions are asked. New questions and new answers are not generally developed, but you schlep out a Shev Shmeitz or a Shep out a Ktsos, and you plug it in, and you answer this question with so-and-so's answer. It's not as creative and as formative as what was going on in Europe before, up until the years before World War II. In fact, it's interesting, the last titan who, in fact, insisted always on always something new, always innovating, never repeating himself, was the Rav. Zatzal. The Rav was emphatic that he would never repeat himself. Everything started from new. In fact, there's a very common story that's told about the Rav, and the truth of the matter is, it happened to me too, so I can say it just for my own life. I don't generally repeat stories that other people sort of tell third hand, but I know I had this, I know that I had this encounter. In 1973, we learned in the summer shiurim, we learned Maseches Krisis. And in the context, by the way, the shiurim were written up incredibly, beautifully by Rabbi Kahn. One of the things that I prepared. But those were incredible shiur. And I take some credit for the fact that I was the one to push that's the masechta that they should do next in the series, because it was just such an amazing summer. Anyways, so the Rav said a certain shot and a certain issue. That was 1973. 7 years later, that was in Boston. 7 years later, we're sitting in New York, and the same issue comes up. So I'm a knucker. I raised my hand. And I said, Rebbe, you know, you said this, this, and this. He says, that's right, but I don't care what I said then. I want to know what I said now, what to say now. Everything had to be rethought. That's not what happens in the 13th century in France. That's what happens in many of the yeshivas today. The phenomenon is, if there's a question, you recycle the answers without necessarily examining them. And that's a sign of the, not the decline, but the end of a creative era, which is sort of ingesting new material. So that really the heroic age of Ashkenaz for Bali Tosfos and for Rashi Tosfos is over by the 13th century. And it's Dafka then that the torch passes to a new place. It passes to Spain. It passes to Spain via Provence and then into Catalonia, which is in northeastern Spain, which culturally is part, it's part Spanish and part Ashkenazic. It really, just like it straddles the Pyrenees, so that area also straddles Jewish worlds. It's where Jewish worlds come together. So in the early part of the 13th century, from the city of Gerona, or Gerona as it's properly pronounced, goes a very unique individual whose name is Rabbeinu Yonah ben Avraham. So we generally know him, we get to know him really well. When? Correct. Right. But when else? When does everybody walk around? When can you? Well, you're, I don't know how many people are. You're here first year, right? Okay. So if you ride on the sub, if you get to be here next Elul, you walk around on the buses. That's when you'll see Rabbeinu Yonah. Why? Right. Because he's better known, or he's best known for his Musar book, which is called Shari Tshuva. However, in terms of, he made an equally, maybe even greater contribution to Torah, not through his Musar, but through his learning, because he went to France to study the Shita and the Derech HaLimud of the Balei HaTosfos. In our case, he went to Normandy, to the town of Evreux, where he studied. He brought the Shita back to France. And back to Spain. And he shared it with his first cousin, whose name was, well, his non-Jewish name was Bonastruc de la Porta, Magister Judaeorum, Rabbi Bonastruc de la Porta. You know him better as Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, otherwise known as the Ramban. Never thought about the Ramban having a Goyish name, did you? But I can't really object to people not having, you know, having non-Jewish names too, because, yeah, anyways. And Rabbeinu Yonah and his cousin, the Ramban, were tremendously enthused by this new method, which for them was a revolution. They weren't really aware of what Rabbeinu Tam had been doing in France and expanding the parameters of learning the way that we described it last week. Except what? And take a look, for example, Rabbeinu Yonah and his parish on Avos, okay? Gives you an indication of the kind of enthusiasm that he has for what Bali Tosfos do. On the Mishnah in the second parakeet Mishnah in second parakeet Mishnah in Pirkei Avos Mishnah Zion, the Gemara, the Mishnah says Mar beChochma Mar beYeshiva, says Rabbeinu Yonah wrote Salomar Chochmas Hasvara vaHapilpul, logic, analysis, sharp distinctions. Shall Yedeza who Mar beYeshiva. Ki avoa talmidim, because that's how you make your, that's how you establish your yeshiva. Ki avoa talmidim l'shmoa divrayim chadashim ulitchadedimo, to sharpen your minds, or as Professor Tversky used to say, sharpen your minds. V'lilmod inyan asvara hamitchadeshet ki chokhma b'fnei atzma. So it's a brand new discipline of learning. You can feel the excitement in his words. So he starts writing Tosfos. Starts writing in dialectical kind of argumentation, the way that we saw the Tosfos do. However, he does it in a different way. You'll take, there's a fundamental difference in Tosfos and what the Sfardim do. Tosfos write Tosfos. You know, they write additions to the Gemara, to Rashi, whatever the word refers to. Sfaradim, Tosfos. You'll never find Tosfos or Ramban or Tosfos or Rabbeinu Yonah. What will you find? Chidushim. Okay? Or Chidushim. There's a very big difference between the two. Tosfos is pegged to the Gemara. So that you'll find Tosfos that will discuss Havaminas. You'll find Tosfos that will discuss words. You'll find Tosfos that will discuss Rashi. You'll find Tosfos of all kinds. In other words, as much as I told you last week, Rashi's Perush liberated learning and allowed for everybody to learn independently. They were still all, in addition to, you know, to the pyrotechnics of dialectic and what we saw in the Gemara and Avodah Zarah, which creates whole new categories. There were all kinds of little odds and ends that could be dealt with also, and Tosfos does that. In Spain, they don't do that. In Spain, if you take a look, if next time you're tomorrow morning, when you open up the Rashba, you open up the Ritva, you open up the you're right. Actually, the truth of the matter is, on Kesubis, you get everybody. The whole 9 yards is there. The Ramban, everybody. You open up and you see, and Rabbeinu Yonah quoted in the Shifta Mikubetzet. You find more than anything else, focused essays. The issues that the way that the chidushim of the Sfaradim are formulated is that they're interested in essays on topics that arise from the Gemara, and generally they come down, they endorse one answer to whatever issue is being raised, and have a very, very heavy emphasis on the halachic upshot of the sugya. Tosfos, you know, give you 45 different answers to every question. You have no idea which, it's like a shopping list. They give you everybody's answer, and good, so you decide. There's no bottom line. Among the Sfaradim is a bottom line. We talked about this 2 weeks ago, because there were two different approaches to halachic truth between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. For Ashkenazim, balagan. Ashkenazim like balagan. They like multiple answers, and they leave it all open, and we're not going to posket everything, and we're going to go with the flow. The Sephardic position is that no, God gave, truth is indivisible. There can only be one truth, and therefore we have to get to it, and anything else is wrong. And also, at the end of the day, the function of learning is psak. That is already found, interestingly, in both cases, in the Rambam. The Rambam, in number 5, this passage from a letter that he wrote to a student of his, he writes as follows. The Rambam. Now, this is before Baal HaTosfos was come, but the Rambam here is explaining this sort of a traditional Sephardic position of one truth and also the need to emphasize halacha in this passage. A student of his had written to the Rambam and asked him, "What should I study?" So the Rambam writes back as follows: "Vatzatihi, my advice to you is, shetase yigiyacha hamischar, go into business." Because the Rambam was dead set isn't even the word. I mean, the Rambam was totally opposed to taking money for Torah. So he said you should go into business, v'limud ha'refuah, and learn how to be, and go to medicine. And the two were not mutually contradictory. At the same time, im ha'esek b'talmud Torah be'emet, and occupy yourself with true Talmud Torah. Now, the Rambam, true Talmud Torah for the Rambam is, here is a code. It's not just learning, it includes philosophy, but we're not going to go into that. Velo telameh, and don't teach, or don't study even, ele hilchot haravzal, concentrate on studying the Rif. V'tashveh oto lachibur. And then, after you finish learning the Rif, you can go compare it to the Chibur. The Rambam, when he was referring to the Mishnah Torah, always calls it the Chibur. V'mitzate machloket, and if there's a difference of opinion between me and the Rif, teide'u she'iyun ha-talmud mevilakach. That's what's responsible, is we both interpret the Gemara differently. V'tidrushuhu b'mekomotav, and then look up in the Gemara where the sugya is, and you'll be able to decide on your own which opinion, who says what and why. Notice, he says start with the Rif and then compare it to the Rambam. Both, what do the Rif and the Rambam have in common? They're both psak, number one. Why start with the Rif? Because it gives you the background of the sugya without, or the halachic, you know, the major machlokas, without... Without, it's worse in New York and the Northeast, although they didn't have the, I don't know what that was today, whatever. They don't have the sepia sky, the way my daughter put it. In any event, okay, without the intervening, yes.
Do you think that the Sephardic sages, you know, from the time of Rambam to Rabbi Yosef Karo, even to the modern period of Rabbi Yosef, are trying to codify and make Pesach in order to hasten the Geula. There's more of an emphasis on this Kabbalistic.
No. I do agree. I agree emphatically with half of what you said, and I disagree emphatically with the other half, except for maybe Rosef Caro. On the question of Geula, you know what? Maybe not. I was too strict. I was too quick. It's possible the Rambam thought that the Mashiach was coming and that the Mishnah Torah would be the constitution, because he says in one place that he has a tradition from his father that the Mashiach will come in the year 1240. Well, apparently he didn't come, but anyways. Yosef Kaur certainly was involved in certain messianic predilections. However, Rav Avadia, I think, is definitely not. And I think that, but I think if we take the Mashiach out of it for a minute, there is one thing that they all have in common from the earliest days of Spain in the 10th century, even back to Bavel, is the fact that the emphasis of learning is for halacha lemaisa, lasuke shmata ta'aliba de hilchata, and Rav Avadia was very much against pilpul and all kinds of theoretical study, number one, and number two, was this idea that there's only one answer. Okay, it's either right or it's wrong. That's true. And in fact, this idea of only one true answer, there is no question in my mind that one of the reasons why Rav Avadia worked so hard that everybody should accept the opinion of Rabbi Yosef Caro was specifically because of Rabbi Yosef Caro himself complains about the fact that there's more than one opinion, and that is it's almost blasphemous, because how can one God give more than one answer? Anyway, so he says. So he says, and so in other words, you focus your learning on the Sifrei Halacha, and only use the Gemara as sort of a backdrop to your learning. Ve'im techalez mancha befeirushim, but if you spend your time, techalez more than spend. It's if you use it up. If you use up your time with interpretations, beperushei havayot haGemara, and getting into the back and forth of the Gemara havayot, like Abaye v'Rava, va'otam hadvarim asher hinachnu me'amalam, those things which we've saved you from, harei ze ibud zman umiyut hatoelet. It's a waste of time and of no value. This is one of these statements. I'm sure if they showed this to Reb Chaim would say that it was Picorsus. But the Rambam definitely said it. Why? Because the Rambam's take on what you learn Gemara for is, in fact,
Psak.
And therefore, everything between stating the major machlokas and coming to the bottom line, if you have an okimta, in other words, one Amora says I can prove my point from here, and the other Amora says no, it's not necessarily convincing, so we got to go weiter. What? Oh, Reb Chaim wrote essays on the Rambam. The Rambam, what Reb Chaim did was something totally different, and that'll be for another course. Like that's much more. But you do Reb Chaim. You can ask yourself. You know what? Next time you open up Reb Chaim, ask yourself, what is Reb Chaim doing? Okay. In any event, and Rav Moshe, by the way, has a wonderful essay in the Torah Rada Journal called "What Hath Brisk Rot?" Well, I can't even say it. What hath brisk rot? So I said, in fact, there's a whole volume that Rabbi Blau from YU wrote, also a lovely volume called Lomdus, which explains, there's all kinds of modes of Lomdus, but the truth of the matter is that the spirit of Rabbi Chaim is hovering over that entire volume, so I highly recommend it. And I think it's all online. I don't think it, because those books cost like $50, but I think you can actually download it. Well, the library has it. No, I think it's in YU Torah, so you don't have to spend the money. Okay. In any event, so you see these two elements already in the Rambam. Comes the Ramban, and he adopts the Shita Bali Tosfos, which is expansive, multiple answers. So isn't that a contradiction? So what he does is first he adopts and then he adapts. He together with Rabbeinu Yonah adapt Bali Tosfos. He uses a dialectic and analysis to be able to understand the opinions in the Gemara at various stages, but at the end of the day, there's a bottom line and there's a Psak Halacha. It comes beautifully, where you find it beautifully expressed, in fact, is in Rabbeinu Yonah. The works, the perishim of Rabbeinu Yonah, he didn't actually, to the best of my knowledge, he didn't give them a name. They're known as Aliyot Rabbeinu Yonah. And, he also had Kabbalistic tendencies, apropos. So maybe he was like, you know, he maybe was getting going up in the stratosphere. No, because every single essay that he has there, he finishes with the statement Ha'ole lanu mikol ze. In other words, what's the upshot of everything? And that's what he does. So they write chidushim, which are focused essays on topics which come up within the Gemara. So they merge the two worlds, and in fact, it's even better than that. They not only merge the two worlds, they take them one step. They take them one step further. Take a look at numbers at page 6, the last section. I heard this. You know, it's funny. Rav Lichtenstein is quoted as saying this in Mivakshei Panecha. The conversations he had with Rav Chaim Sabato. I heard the Rav say this, that I thought I was going to fall off my chair when I heard this. The truth of the matter is, I can still hear it even though it was like 40 years ago. Remember the Rav saying, when we learn, the Ramban, among other things, wrote halachic monographs. Halachic and lomdische monographs. One of the most important ones that he wrote was called the Kuntres Dina de Garmi. What's Garmi? Anybody know? Okay, it's okay, but don't put it in context.
There's another fact on the way before it's directly linked to you getting the
time. Right, what's the issue?
Well, I don't
know the question. The question is indirect causality in torts. In other words, if I take a rock and I throw it at a window, so I broke the window, so there's no question that I'm responsible. What happens if I indirectly cause the damage? I don't know. I can't even, I'm trying to think of the... Right, you open the gate, whatever the case might be. It's indirect. So that's called grumma benizokin. If you cause indirect damage, then you're putter, okay? Because that's not called, there's no tsiruf between your action and the nezek. There's a middle case, there are middle cases that are called garmi, that pop up in Baba Kama and a few other places. In Baba Metzia, there's a couple of sugyas also. Garmi is a case where the involvement, where it's not totally indirect, but it's not totally direct. Something happens in the middle. One of the classic examples is, you know, if I lend money to somebody, and then that person gives me an IOU, and I hold the IOU, and as long as I have the IOU in my hand, so I can go and I can claim the money. It's not the shtar that I'm holding doesn't have value per se, but it's the instrument that I can use to go and enforce my debt. The debt is something which is independent, and the money itself and the shtar itself is of no real value. So what happens if I go in and I go into the guy's portfolio and I burn the portfolio with all of his IOUs from all the people? Now, I didn't really do anything. I mean, I have to pay him for the paper maybe. But I didn't really do anything because the debt's still there, all right? All I did was destroy evidence, but the evidence has no inherent value. But I did cause some damage. That's a case of garmi. So the Gemara asks the question: Dayan din in the garmi or lo dayan din in the garmi? Do we consider this to be direct or culpable damages, or is it inculpable damages? And we paskin danin and dayan, you got like Reb Meir, dayan din in the garmi. That is a case where if I go in and I burn all these what are they called? All these IOUs, then I can be brought to court, and you can sue me for the damages. Okay, that's the Gemara. Tosfos notes that there are, I don't remember, you know what, I forgot to look up how many, there are half a dozen cases like this scattered throughout the Gemara, and the position of the Ri, of Rabbi Yitzchak Azokin, Rabbi Yitzchak of Dampier is, you know what, the truth of the matter is that Garmi and Grumma are both Pater. But Chazal decided to obligate the person who did the damage, Midrabanan, because I'm not going to say Tikkun Olam, most abused two words in the Hebrew language, because for purposes of equity and justice. But there is no logic, says Tosfos, to why they picked these cases and not others. Okay? Yafe. In fact, and a good Dafyomi Magachir would probably say, "Ah, it's a bunch of gezeiros," and that's it. Okay, the Ramban has a whole different ballgame. The Ramban is a whole different ballgame. At the bottom, he writes this kuntras, he writes this this monograph, and he says as follows. Lefichach ani omer. He says, therefore I say, Shagozel chametz vava lava pesach ubaachar v'sorfo shechayiv l'tzaylishalem l'gazlin. Okay? This is another case of garmi, that I stole chametz, and then it was chametz shavah lava pesach, and then somebody else came and burnt it, but it has no value because, you know, while it's gone, it became chametz shavah lava pesach. And then he starts going in, okay, to the whole question of why this would be the case. And then after he finishes his explanation, the line that's important here, is the middle one. Katavti zos asvara ve'ena nechona. The isal kedai tachnosahu. He says, I'm giving you sort of like an ad hoc reason, but that's based on the premise that every single one of these cases of garmi are prohibited for independent ad hoc reasons. The knas tam. He then goes and devotes his entire monograph here to finding an underlying conceptual framework to explain all of the cases and integrate them into a broader framework. In other words, does Tosfos one better? Tosfos says, it's about Gezeiros. No, we have to take this method and analyze more deeply to be able to get to the root of the common denominator of all the cases that we accept as the garmi, and build them into a large substrate. That's a brand new Holden ballgame. That's a whole new ballgame. And if you'll notice, if you pay attention sometimes, if you read the Ritva, who's the Talmud of the Ramban, or the Ra'or, or the Rashba, who's a Talmud Muk of, the Rashba also, it's easier to translate the words of Sephardic Rishonim into the language of Brisk, into conceptual analysis, than that of Tosfos sometimes. And the reason simply is because they were more conceptual. They took it that one step further. And also kept things tight and straight with one answer and with a halachic bottom line. So that on the one hand, they continue what Tosfos does, but they bring it to a level which was way beyond. I'm not going to give the Ri and the Rabbeinu Tam every single bit of credit, but it's a whole nother ball game, and which allowed again for keeping things heavily on track of halacha lemaisa. Okay, is that so far? Okay, yes, sir. Oh, so the Rav said. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me. One day we actually learned. First of all, you should know that in the 8-volume set, I don't get percentages or anything like this. But Rav Lichtenstein actually said shiurim on the din. It's Kuntras Dini Garmi, and it's one of the blue books, and it's really phenomenal. I learned it straight through with my. I learned the Kuntras Dini Garmi with the Rav also in the 70s, and yes, I put them. We were learning them side by side. Whoever did the notes of the shiurim, because I didn't use my own notes because I was too busy. Anyways, I wasn't a good stenographer. It was an interesting experience, but there were phenomenal shiurim revines. In any event, we were learning the kuntras dini garmi. So in the middle, after we did it the entire ben hazmanim of January and early February, while the college kids were taking exams, and the Rav sat back and said, I'm afraid to say this, but I think the Ramban was greater than the Rambam. And we're all going, wow, that blew you out of the room. That was pretty amazing. Okay, Beseder. I will mention one more thing before we go on. Oh, we're on time. The Ramban was, despite the fact he knew very well that he was taking things way where no man had gone before, right? Or no Rosh Hashiva had gone before. Nevertheless, he was very, very conscious of the fact of his debt to the Balei HaTosfos, and he actually mentions it in one of the most important letters I think was ever written in Jewish history. In the 1230s, what shall we call them? zealous elements within the Jewish community in Provence and Spain decided that Jewish philosophy, which includes medicine and math and music and all kinds of other things, was puzzle. And there was a world war that went on over the writings of the Rambam. Among the things that happened was the Thalaiotosis in France, in Paris, apparently put a ban. They put in Cherem anybody who had the Rambam's books and anybody who actually had them in possession or studied them. The Ramban, who was not a big fan of philosophy, the Ramban himself was a Kabbalist. Is that's all those sections of the Ramban's Parashat and Chumash you're supposed to skip? By the way, so it's an interesting thing about those portions. If you want, let me ask you, if you want somebody to keep a secret, you know what you do? Exactly. If you tell them, it's really too bad I can't tell you what happened because it's a secret, what's going to happen? You're going to nudge you to death until you tell them the secret, right? The Ramban has all these sections in which he says, Zesod, Al Derech HaEmes, don't read it, don't do it. As if, like, somebody's going to say, okay, there are schools actually where they skip it. That's true. It's actually true. The women's Mechlala in Yerushalayim, when they teach, and they teach Ramban Mesudar, get to Derech HaEmes, goodbye. However, immediately after the Ramban died here. The Ramban came on Aliyah in 1267, encouraged in that direction by the Inquisition, and he settled in Akko. He settled in Akko because that was the last place that was ruled by the Crusaders, where they spoke French. Ramban spoke Catalan. Catalan is closer to French. Ramban didn't. It's a question how much Arabic the Ramban knew, because Jews were still speaking Arabic even after the Christian conquest in Spain. In any event, immediately after the Ramban's death, there was like a cottage industry that set up in Akko. But you know, Sfarim, they explained the secrets of the Ramban. So you start saying it. So whatever. And anyways, the Ramban was in fact Kabbalistically inclined, but he didn't like the idea of putting the Rambam in Cherem. So at the bottom, so he writes a letter to the rabbis of France and saying, you know, do me a favor, don't do this. So he writes, look at the last three lines. He says, don't do this to us. You can read the text yourselves. But Roboteno et Sarfatim, our masters, our French masters, Talmidechim Anu, we are your students. Umeimechim Anu Shosim, and we drink your waters. We are totally dependent on you, but please don't do this. We acknowledge your hegemony in terms of learning. Nevertheless, as I said, the Ramban takes things farther. Okay. It's not fair what I'm going to say. But nevertheless, what happens, what I said generally characterizes the Ramban and all the members of his school, which would be his two leading Talmidim, Rav Arna Levi, the Ra'ah, and the Rashba, and their student, the Ritva, and then the Ran afterwards, till we get to the middle of the late part of the 14th century. Although each one of them, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ramban, each one deserves, their own focus, but there's no time. All right. Now, all of the people we have discussed the past 2 weeks, the Gaonim, Rashi, Tosfos, and these Chachmei Sfarad, we describe them as Rishonim. Okay? We say, then, Gemara Rishonim. Those are the guys on the page. It's the guys on the, who's got you on the shelf. After the Rishonim come the Acharonim. Traditionally speaking, where is the line between Rishonim and Acharonim? That's what we say. We say that Rabbi Yosef Karo was the last of the Rishonim and the first of the Acharonim, the same way that Rav was the last of the Tanayim and the early person of the Amorayim. You have these transitional figures. From a halachic basis, that's the rule. I'm not questioning the traditional halachic rule. However, from a literary point of view, from a methodological point of view, even from a psak point of view, that's not accurate. It's not accurate. Why? for precisely the same reason that I told you about the shift between the Gemara, between the world of the Tanayim and the Amorayim on the one hand, and the Rishonim on the other. Remember what I said the difference was? The difference is, that's what you get to be, when you finally grow up and get to be on this side of the table, you get to quote yourself all you want. What happened? Tanayim and Amorayim, I told you, work on the same playing field. They advance the Masara of Torah Shebal Peh. They can develop, Amorayim and Tanayim can develop their own ideas, and they don't have to rely on earlier opinion. Rabbi Yosef Karo himself, in the Kesef Mishnah, in the second parak in Hilchas Mamrim, says, truth of the matter is that Amorayim, yes, it's true. Generally, Amorayim are not allowed or don't allow themselves to express an opinion unless they can back it up with an opinion of a Tana. However, that sort of, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, that's sort of like a deference to the greatness of the Tanayim. In principle, it's not necessary. In principle, Tanayim and Amorayim do the same thing. They're advancing the same cause, and they're pushing the world of Torah Shebal Peh forward. With Chasimas HaGemara, with Ravina and Ravashi, or whoever, in the 5th century, or the early 6th century, whenever it happened, okay, that stops. And from then on, I told you, the Gemara is the written, or the at least codified, constitution of the Jewish people, and you're not allowed to have an opinion about anything unless it passes muster with a source in the Gemara. So, learning Torah goes from expanding to study of a text. Okay? Now, in the 14th century, in the mid-14th century in Germany, Jews are thrown out of France in 1306 and then frequently back and forth over the course of the century, so I'm going to leave it there. In the mid-14th century in Germany and about 50 years later in France, there's a fundamental switch in the way people learn. And the assumptions of learning change. What are the two assumptions? I told you, when you go from period to period, two assumptions. Assumption number one is that you now study the words of those previous to you as a text and not as a colleague. And the other side of that is you don't reject the opinion of somebody in that world without the backing of somebody else's. All right? I will give you an example. Take a look at the text that I just gave you today. This is a very famous tshuva of the Tosfos Rid, Rabbi Yeshayahu ben Meli. It's an interesting Italian Jewish name. Ben Meli of Trani, lives in the 13th century, Tosfos Rid. Sometimes he's printed on the side of the book, sometimes not. His grandson is mentioned in the, if you take a look at the back, if you're really thorough and you're learning the Rif, and you look at the Shiltei Giborim, he always quotes the Riaz. The Rabbi Yeshayahu Achron Zal, the Lamed fell off somewhere. Apparently it was too expensive to put in. So, but anyways, that's this Tosfos Rid's grandson. In any event, he was an Italian, but he went to Germany to study, and he's a major Rishon. He has a series of tshuvas. He has a very important book, a set of tshuvas, but this tshuva in particular is important for what I want to discuss with you. Tchilas Kol, he has a shaila in Hilchos Mikvos. Tchilas Kol, he says, Tchilas Kol Davar, ani meshiv ladoni, I want to respond to you. Apparently the Rid had written a tshuva in Hilchis Mikvos in which he had explicitly rejected the opinion of Rabbi Yitzchak of Dompierre. Now this is a generation after the Ri, and you have to understand, that's like saying, who's Rabbi Moshe Feinstein? who's Rav Shlomo Zalman, really? I mean, you know, I'm going to disagree. And so so he paskened against the Ri, and some other guy said, who are you? You know, this is Rav Shlomo Zalman. You know, you're not even a member of Rashi's family. What are you doing here? So he says, Chalila li, it's not true. Me'asod zot, I would never do such a thing. V'lo al tab machshava kecholek alav. It never occurred to me to dismiss him and disagree with him. I'm just a bedbug. I mean, what am I? I'm a flea. Okay, Kenega Talmido, Afki Bedaber Achre, Afki Bedaber Achre Melech. In Yiddish, you'd say Chabina Gornished. However, Achzot Iti, okay, nevertheless, I am convinced, Kol davar sheino nireh beinai. If I think something's wrong, I amara Yehoshua ben Nun lo tziat melech. Even if Yehoshua ben Nun had said it, it's a Gemara, I wouldn't pay attention. I wouldn't accept it. I wouldn't obey. Despite the fact that my intelligence is limited, I'm not going to hold myself back. And I apply to myself the pasuk v'adabra beivotecha neged melachim v'lo evosh. Okay, and I will speak of God's Torah even in the presence of kings. Man malchi rabbanon. Melachim is commonly interpreted to mean rabbis. I'm not going to be embarrassed if I have an opinion, if I think I'm right. The Eidai Bashachak Neman, Sela, my witnesses in heaven, Sha'af b'mokum sh'nirali sh'ani omer yafal kol echad midivri rabotai yarishonim, chalila sh'achicheni libi lomar af achmati amda. But nevertheless, I don't say I'm smarter than them, God forbid. Ela anidan be'atzmi mashal ha'pilosofim. I apply to myself a parable, or an example that was provided by the philosophers. Now we know where this came from. This is what we're about to see. He's quoting a 12th century scholastic Catholic philosopher named John of Salisbury. Now, how did he know that? It's an interesting question. But we know he knew Moreau Nevuchim quite well. So I'm not wouldn't be surprised that he was in contact with. After all, it's Italy. Anyways, anidan ba'atzmi mashal ha'pilosofim. Shamati michach me'apilosofim. I spoke to non-Jews, learned non-Jews. Sha'alu l'gadol b'lehem. So what did they ask the greatest of all of them? V'amrulo. And they sent him. Halo anachnu modim sha'rishonim chachmu v'yiskilu yoter mimenu. In those days, it was by definition that the older generations, the earliers, knew more than the later generations. There was a sense of decline of the generations. It's called mihitkatnut dorot or miyut dorot. It's not like today where it's, you know, this new and improved is always better, you know, whatever it is. I just got this terrible notice that we're going to system 9.1 on Apple. I mean, that's always better and improved. In traditional societies, older, closer to the origins, closer to revelation, is always new and is always better. In fact, the famous story about Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, who was Rosh Shiva of Tarvadas, that he was sitting on the plane coming to Israel, and one of his children was attending him, and was asking, you know, talking in third person, and getting this, getting him that, and he's sitting next to a Jewish guy, and on the plane. So the guy says to the other guy says to Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, "Tell me, I don't understand. My children, I can't do enough for them, and your son can't do enough for you. How does that work?" So he says, "It depends." See, so Rabbi Yaakov's a very clever guy. So Rabbi Yaakov said, "Look, it depends on what your perspective is." He says, "You think that everything is new and improved is better. So therefore, by definition, the children are better than the parents. And on my world, whoever's closer to Sinai has more authority and more valence. And therefore, my son defers to me." Anyway, so that was the assumption. That was the assumption throughout the Middle Ages. So he says, "How is it possible if we assume we all know that the antiqui, the earlier ones, are greater than the moderni, the later ones, the modern ones?" Halo anachnu modim shadu min abrim aleihem v'sotrim divrayhem b'harbe mekonot v'ameti tada. But we disagree with them all over the place. How does that work? Heyach yikon hadavar hazeh. How can that work? Heshivam. He replied, "Amar lehem mitzofel merachok. Who sees farther? Hananas or hanak? The dwarf or the giant?" Heveil meir ha'anak. Obviously, the giant sees farther. She'inav omdot b'makom gavoa yoter min ha'ananas. He sees farther than the nanas. The midget is down here. However, im tarkiv ha'ananas al tzavarei ha'anak. But if you put the dwarf on top of the giant, who sees farther? Heveil meir ha'ananas. At that point, the dwarf sees farther. She'inav gvohot achshav yoter meinei ha'anak. Because he can see all that much further. So we are dwarfs who are sitting on the shoulders, on the necks of the giants. We see and appreciate and live off of their wisdom. We depend on it. Everything we know from them. But we could see a little bit further. Okay, now what the Tosfos read here is saying is very simple. He's saying, I have the right to disagree with the Re because I could see a little bit further, not because essentially I'm greater. He would never say such a thing. Nevertheless, he's still playing in the same field. All right? He has his own opinion, which he's voicing against the Re. Now, This is the early part of the 13th, say, between second, first third and second third of the 12th, 13th century. 100 years later, that would never fly. If you look at all of the tshuvas of the early, of sort of like the I don't know what to call them, the late medieval Ashkenazic poskim, for example, Maharil and Maharival and Rav Moshe Mintz and Mari Kolon, Mari Bruna, these are not names that you probably know well, because none of you study for Smicha yet. I do research in this too, but that's not the point. When I was learning for Smicha, we started doing sugyas and Gemara, you know, Gemara Ashitosis, Hala Rishonim, Rosh, whatever, and then Yeridea. And I have to tell you that there was absolutely no connection, or very little connection, between what we learned with Gemara Rashi Tosfos and all the Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch. Something had transformed things in the meantime, because the halacha didn't look anything like what came off of the Rif or the of the Rush. And what came was there was this entire world of intermediate poskim, let's call them. And they were the ones who transmitted and transformed the Ashkenazic tradition from the time of the classical Rishonim to the time of the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch. Oh. If you look at the way that these poskim, Maharil, Mari Bruna, these are the names that pop up in Shulchan Aruch and the Torah and so on, not on the Torah, in the before Shem on the Torah, if you take a look at what they do, how they operate, it's a whole other ballgame. Number one, they don't out and out, they would never out and out disagree with a Rishon. In other words, if there's a machlokas between, if they want to express an opinion, they will only do so by virtue of the fact that they have another, what we'll call a Rishon, to back them. And they'll do anything they can not to even decide among Rishonim, because who are they? They're living in another world. And that's what makes them Rishonim, Achronim. Because they say, I'm living in a different period. I'm dependent totally on the Rishonim for anything I have to say. How you gauge whose opinion you accept, it's another story. But you're another ballgame. I'm dependent and defer in total to the world of the Rishonim, Rashi, Tosfos, Ramban, Rashba, whoever it is. That's point number one. So you wouldn't have a case of somebody in the 15th century would say, oh, I can see further and disagree with all Rishonim because I can see farther. No. The only one who does that, there's only one person who does that later on. The Gro. The Gro does that. And that's why we say that, I mean, the Gro was a phenomenon. But that's why I say the Gro acted like a Rishon. Because that's what he did. The Ran's over here. I don't like the Ran. The Rambam. The Gro can do all this stuff. But aside from the Gro, there's nobody else who does that. From the 14th century on. And that's part of the shift from Rishonim to Acharonim. That's point number one. Point number two, in terms of learning, will come actually sound more familiar. Tosfos, when Tosfos disagrees with Rashi, okay, does Tosfos bother to ask himself, what was Rashi thinking? Do you ever encounter that? Where Tosfos tries to farem for Rashi? Think about this for a minute. They'll say, why did Rashi say this? And then they'll give a different answer. But overwhelmingly, Tosfos will say, Rashi perish bakuntris X, velo nihira, or tema, or yesh lahakshos, or yesh makshim, whatever the case might be. And they give a teretz. But they don't go back and try to figure out what was Rashi thinking. All right? That's because they live in the same world. They don't accept Rashi. Goodbye, I'm going to have my own answer. Once we get to the time of the Achronim, that all changes. And now, learning is no longer just, what does the Gemara say? And I'm going to sit there and argue with the Ri and the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rid and this one, that one, what I think the Gemara is saying. Now, learning has become learning Gemara with Rishonim. And Yutaka asks, what's Rashi's? Svara. And what's Rashi's? Shita. And we ask ourselves, how can we be medayik in Rashi to figure out why Rashi, what perish, there's something called Shmira that we do. What's Shmira? If you look at Rashi carefully, you can often see that Rashi formulated words in such a way so as to avoid an answer, to avoid an optional interpretation. In other words, you can ask Rashi not only what did you say, but what didn't you think you should say, or what didn't you want to say. So instead of being devoting yourself only to the text of the Gemara and trying to figure out what the Gemara alone says, we're also trying to decipher what was Rashi thinking. Listen, we do it with the Rambam. I mean, that's like unbelievable. There was a great professor of philosophy at Harvard, Professor Harry Wolfson, who was actually a Talmud in Slobodka before he became a professor. He used to talk about in the world of philosophy of recreating the latent thought processes of various people. And generally, in the original case he was talking about Spinoza. What do we do with the Rambam? You take the Rambam's psak and then you recreate the Rambam's mahalach in the sugya. How do you get there? Minastam kach pirish haRambam. In other words, we're working to understand not just the Gemara, but also to understand how the Rishonim understood the Gemara, what would Rashi reply to Tosfos, and so on and so forth. That's a major shift. And we talk about Shitas Rashi and Shitas Ramban and Shitas Aroah, and that's all the post. That's all those footnotes in the various editions of the Rishonim that we use today. That's a very different type of learning. It's a very different type of learning. And that's the learning of the Achronim. Take a look. Take a look at the text that I gave out today. Look at number 3. This is a tshuva. Of a person who at the time was considered to be one of the Gdolei Olam in the Ashkenazic world. His name was Rabbi Yochanan Treves. He was the chief rabbi of France. The Jews had been thrown out of France at that point, I think. In 1394, Jews were never allowed back. Were not allowed back to France until 1789. And despite what they'll tell you on television, the Franco-Jewish experience has been complicated, basically. In any event, Rabbi Yochanan Treves writes about the way, is here engaged in learned correspondence with somebody else, we don't know who it is, about a certain steer. Hold on. Middle of the first line. He says, somebody wants to make a diuk and so on. As I thought when I was young, al diktukim yefalplu charifim aloshin yosar atanayim, the way that people would be medayik if you could say it this way and not that way, they would be very careful to measure every single word, every single letter in the Gemara. Gama mefarshim al perish Rashi, just people would spend their time interpreting Rashi. Call the chad yefarish ledato. Everybody interprets it in their own way. Midaloma, since he didn't say this way. Midalokam ha'chi, ma'alachi. Shema minadato kach. Since he said this way and he didn't say that way. Ah. And why? The assumption was because, in his day, second half of the 14th century, we assume that Al Rishonim wrote, he says here in Baruch HaKodesh. Now, the truth of the matter is that Rashi's achievement early required Ruach HaKodesh, but that's not the point right now. The assumption is that every single one of the words of the Rishonim are written in the exact type of precision as the Gemara. And therefore, we devote ourselves, we're meshabit ourselves, to understand the Rishonim and to squeeze out every single bit of information in them. So your world is now that of Gemara with Rishonim, and I don't know, sometimes you spend more time with the Rishonim than you do, in fact, with the Gemara. You have these dapim that have like this much Gemara, that much Rishonim. That's true. Now I'm not saying they don't go together, but I am saying that the two. But it's not quite the same. Okay, Tosfos does not spend as much time with Rishonim as we do, which is fine. It's just different. Okay, I'm just going to add, since we don't have a lot of time, I'm just going to add what happened. Now that's fine. Because that expands the parameters of Torah even further. Because now you take all the ideas that arise from Rashi and from Tosfos and so on, and you run with them. However, it can get very kvetching. It can get very kvetching, and you can get overly sophisticated. and give so many svaras and squeeze so much meaning into words that the words don't take them anymore. Also, around the same time, at the same time as people were trying to really just understand what Yerushalmim were saying, something developed called pilpul. Now, pilpul just means sharp analysis, but this was a formal type of analysis which took off both among Sephardim and Ashkenazim in different forms, which sort of went something like this. You have a back and forth in the Gemara. Emach log is a bivarav. Okay, like that. Abaye, do you think there's anything wrong with Abaye? No, Abaye is Abaye. Certainly nothing wrong with Rava. So Rava was so sharp, he must have known what Abaye's position was, and he must have already figured out all the answers against Abaye before he said what he's going to say. So let's reconstruct everything he thought in advance before he said what he had to say, and then we'll ask ourselves, why did he say it anyways? And since Abaye knew what was coming, why didn't he accept Rava in the beginning? Now, that you find things like that in the Gemara, but you see, take it one step further, all right? And it becomes a very attenuated and very speculative, spectacular, hard to follow. And a lot of poskim say, this is silly, this is just mental gymnastics. What did he think in advance? So he said it anyways, he should have said it the other way, he should have known what the guy's objection was going to be in advance. And this is what people did. That was learning. Postgame idea, we don't have time to go into the sources I have here. They say, that's a derech sheker, but we do it in yeshivas anyways. Okay? And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. In the end, and that's how people are learning in yeshivas. And it's got nothing to do with halacha. Especially in Ashkenaz. Nothing to do with halacha. In fact, they make fun of people who learn halacha because they're not doing all these intellectual pyrotechnics. And you've got hundreds of svarim, pilpul svarim like this, in the library nobody opens anymore. Because at some point it got so attenuated and so blue all over the place that it collapsed of its own weight. And it collapsed of its own weight around the late 18th century. And the person who took a broom and swept it away was the Gra. The Gra says, enough with this. We're going back, and we're going to learn Gemara and Rishonim, and that's it. And if we're going to do halacha, we're going to just look at poskim who are responsible. And it was not. And if you, by the way, if you take a look at the and he developed his theory of learning, which later became institutionalized in Volozhin by his Talmud Muvhak, Talmud Chaver, whatever, Reb Chaim Volozhiner. What did they learn? They learned Gemara and Rishonim. All these pilpul svarim go the way of the world. There was a time, there's still some places, where nobody opened the Gemara without looking at the Marsha and the Chachma Shlomo and the Pnei Yoshua and the Meginei Shlomo. Do you know who the Meginei Shlomo is? Meginei Shlomo, it was one of the most important Lumda Sfarim in the world. There was a sefer to explain it, to farem for all of Rashi's against Tosfos Kashas. It's the grandfather of Pnei Yoshua. Did anybody ever open up a Pnei Yoshua here?
Yeah.
How often?
Okay,
I will tell you, maybe it's just brisk. I know that I was easily 23 before I learned with Achronim. Except for a few, you know, like the Minchas Chinuch and stuff. There was the Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos, the Ramban, Rajba, Ritva, not even the Ritva, Shivtik Mavetzis maybe a little bit, and then there was Reb Chaim. Nothing in the middle, there wasn't much to talk about. But that's an extreme expression of what, if you take a look in the Sfarim that came out of, of Volozhin, the Mishkan Yankiv of Yaakov Kaliner, or the Karin Oro of Yitzchak Kaliner, or the two brothers who were the first generation in Volozhin. Even take a look at the Netziv, who was is wonderful to learn. When he quotes Achronim like the Chassam Sofer, who's already in this other world. It's not a Mefulpol world. And so ultimately. That part, this pilpul part of Achronim falls away, but the shift to Achronim is what we're Achronim, because nobody has an opinion today. It's allowed to have an halachic opinion today, unless you're backed up by Rishonim and early Achronim, Poskim that were accepted as binding. And the way that we learn is to, in fact, explore, enter into the world of the Rishonim, and to explore their world, because they've basically covered all the major possibilities in any given sugya. But the truth of the matter is, I remember the Rav used to also come up with, try to do independent analysis of sugyas without Rishonim. But it was relatively rare. It was relatively rare. One variation, sort of semi-achronic. I don't know if this is true, but I heard it from somebody who was in Volozhin, Baranovich, that Rav Balchanan Hashem Yikom Damo used to say that if you learn Gemara and Rashi well, and then you sit there and you figure out what all the logical options outside of Rashi are, you'll more or less cover all of the Shitos of Rishonim, because they're all logical alternatives. But like, I never learned like that, so I wouldn't know. Yeah. Well, Rav Schechter at YU says we get into the world of the Tachtonim. But it's a good question.
And how will they, if there are something else?
I, you know what Yogi Berra says. It's hard to pick the future, because if you predict the future, because it's just so uncertain. I don't know. Our job, what?
Do you see a shift in the learning methods today, or are we still in the same learning method?
What the Gra does and what Reb Chaim does are two very different things. I know what you mean. I think there are other things that are being taken into consideration. I think I think people are more interested in certain areas, to find out what the historical background of certain opinions was and stuff like that, halakhic opinions. I don't know when it's going to happen, but I think there's a sort of a retrenching of conceptual learning, that it's not as extreme, maybe it's more modified. It's hard to, maybe the words, sometimes in Lomdus, the words of the Gemara end up playing second fiddle to the logic that's attributed to that. So I think maybe there's a modification happening. I don't know. I don't know. I do know that since in the black yeshivas, it's really a matter of like saying over and over again. Eventually, that's going to sort of like have to be shaken up, and sort of new insights develop. But I do know one change that's happened. The yeshivas were always based on the idea that the highest form of avodas Hashem is learning, and therefore there was not a lot of emphasis was spent on spirituality and developing one's relationship with God independently. But the idea was you learn, when you learn, you're experiencing Matan Torah, so therefore that's all you need. That clearly is changing, because even the black hat yeshivas, that people are guys are learning Hasidus, and they're learning all kinds of things from Ruchnius and so on and so forth. So that has certainly changed, and the atmosphere in the yeshivas has changed. But whether methodologically they're going to be major changes, it's hard for me to say. I'm still, my head's still very much in Lithuania, so hard to say. Yes.
If you're going to take the view of like this. Doesn't the Gra sort of make? Couldn't you draw a line, maybe, let's say, around the Chatam Sofer, of like before, after, like when you're allowed to be holy,
That's a good question. The question was in terms of when do you draw the line, in terms of who can disagree with. This is already a different ball game. It is generally accepted that we don't disagree with the Mechaber, the Rama, the Shach, and the Taz. That the Nesivus says. What about people later? You know, the Rav Moshe got into trouble with this. When Rav Moshe Paskin, the first volume of Igros Moshe, so he disagrees with the Behuda and the Chassam Sefer and all kinds of stuff. And there was a rabbi in Queens who wrote a Sefer called Mane Laigoros, at which he wipes the floor with Rav Moshe. How dare you disagree with this one? And how dare you disagree with that one? But if you go through Rav Moshe's introduction to Aruch Chaim and a lot of other tshuvas where he deals with this issue, he says, I don't understand. Kach darka shel Torah. Dar dor v'zorshav, dor dor v'sofrav. That you disagree with other people. That's not like a lack of covet. It's that's the way it works in your own tkufa. So yeah, you could say late achronim, early achronim, because late achronim may end with the mechaber and the ramah. Late achronim already is a different ballgame. That we don't accept every dot of Yehuda or every. There is a sort of tradition as to what is accepted and what's not, and what's at play. So that's still open. There is a certainly the idea that there is unilateral. You have to accept so and so's opinion. Boom. If you're a Bar Hochi, you have the right to an opinion. That doesn't work. That absolutely doesn't work. There's Gemara. Gemara said Baba Basra, where I always forget who it is. I think it's either Rav Papa and Rav Ami or Rav Asi. It's in Baba Basra in the Lamed somewhere, where the Rebbe says to Talmidim, if I pass in a shayla and you receive the you see the tshuva, you disagree with me. Don't accept it. Don't reject it. Don't accept it because you shouldn't go against your own convictions. Don't reject it because if you come and see me, then I might be able to defend myself. You might accept my opinion. After I'm gone. You can't overturn what I paskin, but don't rely on me blindly because ain't l'dayin ela mashein evraos. Every generation has a right to paskin dor dor vidor. But there's a continuum. You know, there are certain Orthodox rabbis who think that they're Reb Moshe, so they can just do whatever they want. Other people say no, you can't say anything. So someplace in the middle, what was it? A very good friend of mine who was in the Talmud Muvak of the Rav once said some people are have too much Yiras HaKavod, and some people don't have enough Yiras HaKavod. And of course, like everything else, it's in the middle. Yeah.
Did the Sephardic Acharonim evolve the same way that the Ashkenazic Acharonim did? Any differences between them?
There are many, many similarities. There are some differences. What the Sephardim have is something called Iyun. Iyun is like Tilpul in many, many ways. It's a lot healthier than the Ashkenazic one for the very simple reason that it always stuck very closely more to the understanding of the Rishonim rather than going off on these tangents that I discussed, and also was always had a much more halacha lemaisa kind of attitude. If you want to get a good sense of what Iyun HaSfaradi is like, take a look at really one of the most important books I've written on halachi methodology, on learning methodology, which is Darchei HaGemara of Rabbi Yitzchak Kanpanton, who was the Godel Ador, the Rosh Shiva in Castile in the generation before the before the expulsion from Spain. All right, like as the Kohen Gadol says on Yom Kippur, Yossi B'Moshe Karasi Kosef Kan. There's a lot more to say, but thank you very much.
Okay.
Rav Yitzchak Kanpanton.